The letters of Stalin and Nadia reveal a difficult but loving marriage.
Hello, Tatka. I miss you so much, Tatushka. I am as lonely as a horned owl, he wrote to Nadia, undergoing treatment in Carlsbad. One of her letters ends, I ask you so much to look after yourself. I am kissing you passionately, just as you kissed me when we were saying goodbye. Your Nadia.
It was never an easy relationship. They were both passionate and thin-skinned. Their rows were always dramatic. In 1926, she took the children to Leningrad, saying she was leaving him. But he begged her to return, and she did. Stalin was often aggressive and insulting, but it was probably his detachment that made him hardest to live with. Nadia was proud and severe, but always ailing. If his comrades like Molotov and Kaganovich thought her on the verge of madness, her own family admit that she was sometimes crazed. After 1929, they were often apart since Stalin holidayed in the south during the autumn, when Nadia was still studying. Yet the happy times were warm and loving. Their letters fly back and forth with secret police couriers, and the notes follow each other in such quick succession that they resemble emails. Even among these ascetic Bolsheviks, there were hints of sex. The very passionate kisses she recalled in her letter. They loved each other's company. It's very boring without you, she wrote. Come up here, and it'll be nice together. She wanted to be a serious Bolshevik career woman in her own right. In the early 20s, she had typed for her husband, then for Lenin, and then for Sergei Orjenikidze, another energetic and passionate Georgian dynamo now responsible for heavy industry. Then she moved to the International Agrarian Institute in the Department of Agitation and Propaganda, where, lost in the archives, we find her work in all its Bolshevik dreariness. Her boss asks his assistant, who signs herself plain N. Alleluyeva, to arrange the publication of a shockingly tedious article entitled We Must Study the Youth Movement in the Village. The new Bolshevik women, such as Paulina, Molotov's wife, were politicians in their own right. These feminists scorned housewives and typists like Nadia. But Stalin didn't want such a wife for himself. He wanted what he called a baba. In 1929, Nadia decided not to go on holiday with her husband, but remained in Moscow for her examinations to enter the Industrial Academy to study synthetic fibers. Education was one of the great Bolshevik achievements, and there were millions like her. Stalin really wanted a baba, but he supported her enterprise. Ironically, his instincts may have been right, because it became clear that she was really not strong enough to be a student, mother, and Stalin's wife simultaneously. Across the Kremlin, the magnates and their wives converged on Voroshilov's apartment, oblivious of the tragedy about to befall Stalin and Nadia. None of them had far to come. Ever since Lenin had moved the capital to Moscow in 1918, the leaders had lived in this isolated, secret world behind walls 13 feet thick, crenellated burgundy battlements and towering fortified gates. These potentates lived in high-ceilinged, roomy apartments once occupied by Tsarist governors and major domos, existing so closely in these spired and domed courtyards that they resembled dons living in an Oxford college. Stalin was always popping into their homes, and the other leaders regularly turned up at his place for a chat. Most of the guests only needed to walk along the corridor to get to the party. Voroshilov, their host, aged 52, was the most popular hero in the Bolshevik pantheon, a genial and swaggering cavalryman, once a lathe turner, with an elegant, almost D'Artagnanish moustache, fair hair and cherubic, rosy-cheeked face. Molotov's wife, the dark and formidable Paulina, always finely dressed, came from her own flat in the same building. Nadia crossed the lane with her sister Anna. In 1932, there would have been no shortage of food, cooked in the Kremlin canteen and brought up to the flat where it was served by a housekeeper, washed down with vodka and Georgian wine in a parade of toasts. Faced with unparalleled disaster in the regions where 10 million people were starving, conspiracy in his party, uncertainty of the loyalty of his own entourage, and with the added strain of a troubled wife, Stalin felt beleaguered and at war. like the others at the centre of this whirlwind, he needed to drink and unwind. Stalin sat in the middle of the table, and Nadia sat opposite him. During the week, the Stalin household was based in the Kremlin apartment. The Stalins had two children, Vasily, 11, a diminutive, stubborn and nervous boy, and Svetlana, 7, a freckly, red-haired girl. Then there was Yakov, now 25, son of Stalin's short first marriage, who had joined his father in 1921, having been brought up in Georgia by his dead mother's family. A shy, dark boy with handsome eyes. Stalin found Yakov irritatingly slow. Stalin had high, and given his own meteoric success, unfair expectations of the sons, but he adored his daughter. In addition to these three, there was Artyom Sergeyev, Stalin's beloved adopted son, who was often in their house, even though his mother was still alive. Stalin was more indulgent than Nadia, who was, in her way, even more self-centered than Stalin. The nanny complained that Nadia was not remotely interested in the children. Her daughter Svetlana agreed that Nadia was much more committed to her studies. She treated the children sternly, and rowed most with Stalin not about his evil policies, but about his spoiling the children. Yet it is harsh to criticize Nadia's behavior. Her medical report and the testimonies of those who knew her confirm that she suffered from a serious mental illness, perhaps hereditary manic depression, and a disease of the skull that gave her migraines. In 1927, doctors discovered her heart had a defective valve, and she suffered from exhaustion, angina, and arthritis. She did not lack for medical care. Nadia was treated by the best doctors in Russia and Germany, but these were not psychiatrists. It's hard to imagine a worse environment for a fragile girl than the cruel aridity of this Kremlin pressure cooker, pervaded by the martial Bolshevism that she so worshipped, and the angry thoughtlessness of Stalin, whom she so revered. She was married to a demanding egotist, incapable of giving her, or probably anyone, happiness. His relentless energy seemed to suck her dry, but she was also patently the wrong person for him. She did not soothe his stress. She added to it. He admitted he was baffled by Nadia's mental crises. He simply did not possess the emotional resources to help her. Sometimes she was almost deranged. The magnates and her family, the Aleluyevs themselves, sympathized with Stalin. Yet, despite their turbulent marriage and their strange similarity of passion and jealousy, they loved each other after their own fashion. The drinking at dinner was heavy, regulated by a Georgian toastmaster. Sometime during the evening, without any of the other revelers noticing, Stalin and Nadia became angry with one another. Hardly a rare occurrence. They were surrounded by the other Bolshevik magnates, all hardened by years in the underground, blood spattered by their exploits in the Civil War, and now exultant, if battered, by the industrial triumphs and rural struggles of the Stalin Revolution. Some, like Stalin, were in their 50s, but most were strapping, energetic fanatics in their late 30s. They were some of the most dynamic administrators the world has ever seen, capable of building towns and factories against all odds, but also of slaughtering their enemies and waging war on their own peasants. They were macho, hard-drinking, powerful and famous. Stars with blazing egos, colossal responsibilities, and Mausers in their holsters. Irritated by Stalin's lack of attention, Nadia started dancing with her louche, sandy-haired Georgian godfather, Abel Yanukidze, the official in charge of the Kremlin, who was already causing scandal by having affairs with teenage ballerinas. Stalin was busy with his own flirtation, with the wife of Alexander Yegorov, a Red Army commander with whom he had served in the Polish War of 1920. Stalin's style of flirting alternated between traditional Georgian chivalry and, when drunk, puerile boorishness. On this occasion, the latter triumphed. He flirted with Yegorova by lobbing bread balls at her. It made Nadia manically jealous. Stalin was no womanizer. He was married to Bolshevism and emotionally committed to his own drama in the cause of revolution, but he was not uninterested in women, and women were definitely interested in him, buzzing around him like amorous bees. His newly opened archives reveal how he was bombarded with fan letters not unlike those received by modern pop stars. "Dear Comrade Stalin, I saw you in my dreams. I have hopes of an audience." Certainly, Nadia, who knew him best, suspected him of having affairs. His bodyguard, Vlasik, later confirmed that Stalin was so besieged with offers that he could not resist everyone. He was a man, after all. Nadia's jealousy was sometimes manic, sometimes indulgent. As so often with jealousy, her manic tantrums and bouts of depression encouraged the very thing she dreaded. All of these things, her illness, disappointment about her dress, politics, jealousy, and Stalin's oafishness, came together that night. It was a political toast that inflamed her. Stalin toasted the destruction of the enemies of the state, and noticed Nadia had not raised her glass. "Why aren't you drinking?" he called over truculently, aware that she disapproved of his starvation of the peasantry. She ignored him. Stalin tossed orange peel and flicked cigarettes at her, which outraged her. When she became angrier and angrier, he called over, "Hey, you! Have a drink!" "My name isn't Hey," she retorted, furiously rising from the table. She stormed out. Polina Molotova pulled on her coat and followed Nadia outside. They walked round and round the Kremlin, as others were to do in times of crisis. Nadia complained, "He grumbles all the time, and why did he have to flirt like that?" She talked about Stalin's dalliance with Yegorova at the dinner. The women decided that he was drunk, playing the fool. But Polina, devoted to the party, also criticized her friend, saying it was wrong of her to abandon Stalin at such a difficult time. Perhaps Polina's party-mindedness made Nadia feel even more isolated. She quietened down, recalled Polina, and talked about the academy and her chances of starting work. When she seemed perfectly calm in the early hours, they said good night. Nadia went to her room, dropping the tea rose from her hair at the door. Stalin's late hours and Nadia's strict attendance at the academy meant that they had separate rooms. In her tiny bedroom, the bed was draped in her favorite shawls. The windows opened onto the fragrant roses of the Alexandrovsky Gardens. Stalin's movements in the next 2 hours are a mystery. Did he return home? The party continued, Shay Voroshilov. But the bodyguard Vlasik said later that Stalin left for a rendezvous with a woman. This could explain Nadia's sudden desperation. However, a resurgence of a migraine, a wave of depression, or just the sepulchral solitude of Stalin's grim apartment in the early hours are also feasible explanations. We will never know the truth, but Stalin probably went drinking at a dacha with some fellow carousers, maybe Yegorova, and he certainly returned to the apartment in the early hours. Nadia looked at one of the many presents that her genial brother Pavel had brought back from Berlin. This was a present she had requested because, as she told her brother, sometimes it's so scary and lonely in the Kremlin with just one soldier on duty. It was an exquisite lady's pistol in an elegant leather holster. Nadia began to write a letter to Stalin. A terrible letter, thought her daughter. When she had finished it, in the small hours, Nadia lay on the bed. The household rose as normal. Stalin always lay in until about 11. It was late when the housekeeper, Karolina Till, tried Nadia's door. Shaking with fright, she found her mistress's body on the floor by the bed, in a pool of blood, the pistol beside her. Nadia was already cold. The housekeeper rushed to get the nanny. They returned and laid the body on the bed before debating what to do. Why did they not waken Stalin? Little people have a very reasonable aversion to breaking bad news to their czars. Fearfully, they telephoned the security boss, Pauka, then Yanukitsa, Nadia's last dancing partner, and Polina Molotova. Yanukitsa arrived first. He alone of the leaders viewed the pristine scene, a knowledge for which he would pay dearly. Molotov and Voroshilov arrived minutes later. One can only imagine the frantic uproar in the apartment as the oblivious ruler of Russia slept off his drink down one corridor, while his wife slept eternally down the other. No one knew what to do. They gathered in the dining room, whispering. Should they wake up Stalin? Who would tell him? How had she died? Suddenly, Stalin himself walked into the room. Someone stepped forward and said, "Yosef, Nadezhda Sergeyevna is no longer with us." "Yosef, Yosef, Nadia's dead." Stalin was poleaxed. This supremely political creature, with an inhuman disregard for the starving millions of his country, displayed more humanity in the next few days than he would at any other time in his life. Olga, Nadia's mother, hurried into the dining room where a broken Stalin was still absorbing the news. She was offered some valerian drops, but she could not drink them. Stalin staggered towards her. "I'll drink them," he said, and downed the whole dose. He saw the body and the letter which, wrote Svetlana, shocked and wounded him grievously. Nadia's brother, Pavel, arrived with his wife, Zhenya, who would herself play a secret role in Stalin's life and suffer for it. They were shocked, not only by the death of a sister, but by the sight of Stalin himself. "She's crippled me," he said. They had never seen him so soft, so vulnerable. He wept. The rumors of murder started immediately. Had Stalin returned to the apartment and shot her in a row, or had he insulted her again and gone to bed, leaving her to kill herself? "The suicide altered history," claims Nadia's nephew, Leonid Redins. "It made the terror inevitable. The magnates had had a wonderful life, but now it ended forever." Nadia's death created one of the rare moments of doubt in a life of iron self-belief and dogmatic certainty. What was the effect of this humiliation on Stalin, his entourage, and Russia itself? Did vengeance for this personal fiasco play its part in the coming terror, when some of the guests that night would liquidate the others? Stalin suddenly picked up Nadia's pistol and weighed it in his hands. "It was a toy," he told Molotov. The man of steel was in a shambles, knocked sideways, exploding in sporadic fits of rage, blaming anyone else, even the books she was reading, before subsiding into despair. Then he declared that he resigned from power. He too was going to kill himself. "I can't go on living like this." Nadia and Stalin had been married for 14 years, but their relationship was deeper and longer than that. They had shared the formative experiences of the underground life, intimacy with Lenin during the revolution, then the Civil War. Stalin had known her family for nearly 30 years, and he had first met her in 1904 when she was 3. He was then 25, and he'd been a Marxist for 6 years.